Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. Now, the early 20th century saw modernist artists and musicians develop an interest in the neurological condition known as synesthesia. The heightened sensory experiences of synesthetes, or those who saw colours when they heard sounds, felt words were associated with specific tastes, or smells were associated with specific shapes, inspired artists to create works influenced by an holistic phenomenal world of porous sensory experiences. In 2005, neuroscientists discovered a new strain of synesthetic experience they called mirror touch synesthesia, a condition that causes extreme forms of empathy in individuals who feel the same sensations of touch, emotion, and spatial awareness as people they observe. Mirror touch could have some striking ramifications for the practice, interpretation, and experience of contemporary art in the 21st century. And pioneering work in linking these two fields has been done by my guest this week. Since the early 2000s, Daria Martin has been making moving image works primarily through the medium of 16mm film, exploring histories of modernism, postmodern dance, and the effective possibilities of non-narrative film. She utilises the floating and sometimes disquieting logic of dreams to produce complex works that are as arresting as they are unique. Last month saw the release of her edited compendium, Mirror Touch Synesthesia, featuring 23 multidisciplinary contributors and published by Oxford University Press. It comes as a culmination of Martin's interest in the subject that has produced three films and a symposium at Tate Modern. From neuroscientific debates to theories of effect and considerations of empathy, the book is a cross-disciplinary marvel that presents a novel way to think about aesthetics in the age of neurodiversity. I caught up with Daria earlier this month and began by asking how it felt to have this ambitious and important book finally hitting the shelves.
Yeah, it feels great. It's been a labor of love, about 3 years in the making for the book itself, and the research that went into it stretched back several more years, which included making three films as well as editing the volume. And the volume was kicked off by a symposium at Tate Modern that was early 2014. Yeah. So yeah, it's been coming for a while. It feels good to finally be here.
One of the things that you do in your work is you're sort of at the centre of a lot of contributors or a lot of people helping you to realise your vision. And once again, you're at the centre of this storm of a new field, basically, because mirror touch synesthesia, I think, emerges informally around 2003, but then the first proper studies in 2005. Mm. And then you're pulling together, like I say, all these people from diverse fields. How did you manage to do that, being at the core of it as an artist? Did anybody question your credentials? Or
for the book itself, you mean, rather than for filmmaking?
For all of it, filmmaking, for the book, and the symposium.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, when you were talking just then, I was slightly confusing the difference between being a film director working with all sorts of collaborators, including a playwright, and I've been working with a theatre director lately, obviously actors, art director, editor, all these people who make up a film crew on one hand, and on the other hand, editing a book which has about as many contributors to it. I guess one crucial difference is that with a book, although perhaps the overall sort of concept was proposed by me, you know, each contributor is bringing very much their own kind of slice of interest to it. But I think there is a kind of common route to the two, in the sense that I came to synesthesia in the first place because it seems to be, as a artistic trope, one kind of analog to that kind of dialogue between diverse perspectives. Historically, let's say back in the late 19th and early 20th century, A lot of artists and musicians and poets were looking to synesthesia as a model for collaborating across disciplines and combining music and theater and painting, for example.
So you're talking sort of like the Wagnerian Gesamtkunstwerk.
Yes,
in a way.
Yes. And Wagner himself would have been a little bit too early to have known about synesthesia, but later on somebody like Kandinsky was making his version of total artworks, or somebody like Scriabin, the Russian composer, was also interested in colored hearing. Scriabin was making keyboards that beamed light, so making a light show out of music, while Kandinsky was making paintings that he hoped would evoke music. And in each in their own way, they were making a kind of total artwork. Later, when film came in, many people talked about film as the new kind of total artwork. So filmmaking does require this sort of melding of different disciplines and sensibilities and media. And in a way, all of these different academic disciplines clustered around the edited volume in a similar way, all talking about synesthesia again. So synesthesia is a sort of nodal point for moving between different sensibilities and media and disciplines.
And that intermedia fluidity is something that you've embraced from the beginning, because I think when you talked about using film, one of the things I think I've read you saying is that you were attracted to it because it was like it pulled together so many different fields, or it had the possibility of enveloping and encompassing so many different fields.
Yes, exactly. And I don't remember who it was now. I don't know if it was Bela Balitz or one of these early film theorists from the 20th century, again from that sort of time, who talked about film as a kind of corollary of mental processes of thought, daydreams, digressions. So it pulls into itself a sort of huge ecology of languages, you could say, but it also quite literally and practically brings together lighting, performance, if you use musical soundtracks, music. I've worked with dancers in the past. I've endowed sets and costumes with a painterly approach, or literally painting on them. So yes, film always appealed to me because it's this kind of limitless container.
And I think that represents some difficulty for the interviewer, because usually on this show, when I talk to artists or theorists, they are kind of distinct. Because I'll be talking to a theorist about a book they've just published, or an artist about the history of their work. And with you, it's a double whammy, because you have this huge, dense text, compendium of text that's just come out, and also a rich history of filmmaking. But there is some kind of uncanny crossover, I think, between both fields, especially in with Miratouch. Now, this is going to be difficult for us to navigate this field because it is so complex and vast. And we're also sitting in quite a tiny room, which is roasting. And we're surrounded by loads of notes. So bear with us as we navigate this field. But maybe one of the good places to start, we'll begin with the book and work our way into your practice. And maybe one of the good places to start is to talk about Miratouch synesthesia. But let's go back and redefine synesthesia itself in the beginning. Now, this is what people term as a condition in which there's a what they call a cross-modal sensory experience. Now, could you just briefly explain what that means in a way?
Sure. So the most common form of synesthesia, it's about 1 in 25, is people who see colors in response to letters and numbers. Now, you wouldn't think of that as crossing between senses, because both colors and visually read letters and numbers are a visual modality, but in any case, it is termed as synesthesia. Another very common form is colored hearing. So somebody who hears a musical note, or it might even be speech, and in response, either in their mind's eye or sometimes projected on a sort of mental screen about a yard in front of their face, a meter in front of their face, they might see blobs of color moving. It's a rather common neurological trait, you could say. It's not a disability. And it takes many forms. So those are two of the most common, but there are dozens and dozens of possible permutations. We think of ourselves as having five senses, so hearing, sight, smell, taste, and touch. But scientists have identified several more that include temperature, pain, proprioception, which is your sense of your body's movement in space and its position in space, what dancers use to navigate the stage, and interoception, which are all of the internal body sensations, including sexual arousal, hunger, heartbeat, breathing. So when you break down all of these senses and think about how one commonly recognized stimulus, a loud clap, might trigger a sensation that's subjectively felt in the synesthete in any of these senses, you know, and vice versa. So the combinations are almost endless.
But for mirror touch, the most basic way of saying it is that if a mirror touch synesthete sees somebody else being touched or touching something, they feel that same sensation, basically. Obviously not the exact same sensation, but the closest approximate feeling that they have in their minds to that.
Exactly.
Which made me think, well, is that synesthesia? But it is, because I guess the cross modality would be vision touch. But what is fascinating about the book is that, and maybe let me just talk about it in an overarching way, is that it sort of feels to me like there's a push and pull between two perspectives, with the mirror touch synesthete's own position in the middle. So on one side you have the neuroscience, neuroscientific point of view, and on the other side the aesthetic point of view. Mm-hmm. Both are trying to approximate in their own ways what the experience of the mirror touch synesthete is. For the neuroscientists, it's like trying to delimit and quantify and narrow down, you know, this is mirror touch synesthesia. And then the aesthetic side are trying to approximate, you know, what it is to be like. And then in the middle, the synesthete just explodes both positions by being this something that is totally unexpected. I mean, what was your feelings when you first discovered this phenomenon and went deeper into it?
Well, there's a lot to address there. One of the things that it made me think of is also, what were the feelings of the scientists and artists who were present the first time that a mirror touch synesthete spoke in public about their sensations? And then I'll tell you more about how I felt. But part of what's really fascinating about this area is that synesthesia research now is shared by artists and scientists, just as it was at the beginning of the 20th century. But really crucial in this sort of research is that it triangulates with the experiences of the synesthete themselves, because the synesthete can share their experiences, and now they can be measured through various kinds of testing, including brain scans and Stroop testing in the laboratory. Now, neuroscientists are interested again in these very subjective sensations, whereas for much of the 20th century, when psychology was only interested in behavior and outward manifestations of mental states, they had no way of looking at it, no way of testing it. They weren't interested. Now, scientists are interested again, but only the synesthete themselves can tell us what they're experiencing, tell us what to look for or what to be interested in. So although I think a few dozen kinds of synesthesia have been documented by neuroscientists, I'm sure there are many, many others yet to be explored. And in the interviews that Eleanor Claghorn and I did for this book, we seemed to alight on one that neuroscientists weren't yet aware of, which is something called mirror proprioception, which we can perhaps come back to. But essentially, it's you're looking at somebody else move and you feel as if you yourself are moving in sympathy with them. But to come back, the contributions of mirror touch synesthetes are crucial. But to come back to sort of how I felt when I first heard about it, I'd been researching synesthesia because my early films especially were modeled a bit on total artworks in a kind of fragile and intimate way. They pulled together performance and painting in this sort of filmic mental space. And I was interested in that history. But at the same time, there's a way in which that history is, you know, it's very well established and, you know, sort of relates to kind of psychedelic light shows. And it's, you know, it's like it's all over our culture,
right? Right, yeah.
And it's also potentially quite inward looking. It's, you know, it has this sort of visionary, introverted quality to it.
Which leads back to the individual. And sorry.
Yes, yeah, yes, yes.
That's important, I think. Yeah.
It is, because, you know, with, let's say, colored hearing, one synesthete might see green in response to a piece of music, and another might see purple. And there are certain common trends, which is kind of an interesting sidebar, but generally they're quite idiosyncratic personal associations, even if in the early 20th century, perhaps some of those early artists were looking for some kind of transcendent, mystical, universal response. That doesn't really exist kind of in the scientific literature. Whereas mirror touch synesthesia, when I first heard about that, soon after it was identified in the sort of science community, it's not so much about internal worlds as it is about social worlds, or it's about both, you could say, at the same time.
Because is the key, I think, yeah.
Yeah, it's what makes it so much more interesting. And just to kind of reiterate what you just described, because it is a kind of strange phenomena. So a mirror touch synesthete will watch someone else being touched, or sometimes will watch an object being touched, and will feel that same touch on their own body. So watch a caress, feel a caress on the sort of mirrored part of the body, or watch somebody scratching their cheek and feel that same scratch on their cheek. They tend not to feel it quite as vividly as if it's actually happening to them, but nonetheless it's a conscious sensation, and it's not something imagined. It's inevitable. It just happens. And to me this is fascinating, because this kind of synesthesia, instead of being hardwired into the synesthete's own internal brain world, is dependent on the world outside for its form.
What is fascinating to me about it is mirror touch synesthesia is a social condition, but there are sort of benefits and hazards. One of the benefits is a closer communality with other people, because you're feeling what they're feeling. But also there's a danger in your own sense of self being obliterated by taking on all of these other emotional displays, I suppose.
Yes, yes.
And it made me feel like that is what was happening. That's what's happening sometimes in your work before it's even been identified as such. And just to go a bit further. But the notion of empathy, which emerges in the book, which goes back to a German romantic, well, I guess art historian of the romantic vintage, talking about
post-romantic, really.
He was almost working
against that
true,
tradition.
Called Robert Fischer, and his notion of empathy being feeling in, or Einfühlung, that made me think that's exactly what you were doing from the start. So with your film In the Palace, when you describe, so basically In the Palace is a film made in a kind of response to Alberto Giacometti's sculpture, The Palace, at
4 a.m.
And you describe wanting to be inside. I thought that was a remarkable coincidence. Have you made these links yourself?
Yes, I mean, I suppose when you find new ideas, sometimes they sort of trickle backwards, and retrospectively it feels as though things were foreordained or something like that. But it's also about kind of selective looking. So, yeah, there's a lot to respond to there. But I think, I mean, the larger question of empathy seems to imply something active. And again, the early root for the English word empathy is this Einfühlung, this German word that literally means in feeling, which implies a active agency, really. It was a neologism, a word coined by Robert Fischer, as you say, who was a philosopher of aesthetics, 1873, I think it was, and he's describing the process of moving into a figurative painting. It's late 19th century, of course, it's going to be figurative. a kind of projecting of himself really into the painting so that he feels as if he is that billowing, stormy sky together with the emotions of anger and stormy moodiness. But I think what's really intriguing is that then within about 20 years, that same word Einfühlung, then translated to English empathy, was used in psychology to apply as it now does to people. So here we are now, more than 100 years later, able to return this idea of empathy, perhaps, to empathy with artworks. And that's the sort of central provocation of this new book, is how might we look at artworks with empathy? But to turn it around, rather than placing a sense of active agency in the viewer, you might also look at it the other way, which is how might artworks or films touch us? You know, how do they affect or touch us in the way that a mirror touch synesthete feels touched by images? Yeah. For the mirror touch synesthete, it's very conscious and literal. For us, it's something subtler. But something else I wanted to respond to in that last piece of thought, and I think the one before that, was is mirror touch a kind of synesthesia, or is it something else? And actually, that's an interesting question, because it seems to open up in these two directions. On one hand, it opens up towards other kinds of synesthesias, like colored hearing and that whole tradition we've just talked about, and there's support scientifically for the idea of categorizing it that way, because many mirror touch synesthetes also have many other kinds of synesthesia, and they've got synesthesia in their families, and it sort of seems to be grouped kind of in some genetic way with other forms of synesthesia. But on the other hand, a really interesting way of thinking about it is that it's a kind of heightened physical empathy that has a basis in all of us. I mean, we all know the feeling of seeing someone else hurt, you know, slash their finger, you know, chopping vegetables, and then, you know, you might sort of go to help them, but you also might automatically grab your own hand
and shrink back in
empathy.
Your own pain. Yeah,
and kind of, you know, maybe even feel something there.
Yeah.
And, you know, likewise, watching, you know, something very sensual, you'll feel aroused, or, you know, it's just a natural human response of empathy. And one of the seemingly obscure connections to mirror touch, which quite quickly telescopes into something not at all obscure but very accessible, is the concept of mirror neurons, or mirror systems, that are a structure that's been found in
macaques,
monkeys, yeah, and the larger structures in human brains in the early 90s, that are thought to account for a certain basis for empathy. And these mirror systems in all of us, when we watch something happening, they fire in sympathy. So there's a way in which we all have neural circuits that are almost imitating what we see. But these things happen below the threshold of our consciousness. They help to support imitation and empathy and perhaps even learning, but we're not aware of them in the same way that we're not aware of our brain's command to our heart to beat. There's so many aspects of our brain's workings that we're not consciously aware of. So the interesting thing about synesthesia is that scientists have looked at mirror touch synesthetes and measured these mirror systems and found that they are overactive. They're much more excited and active than they are in sort of the average population. And so one of the theories about mirror touch synesthesia is called the threshold theory, and it's the idea that for mirror touch synesthetes, these mirror systems are so excited and active that they rise above the threshold of consciousness and are actively, consciously felt as part of the fabric of one's everyday awareness. So if you look at it that way, mirror touch synesthesia offers a kind of window into something much more universal, which is a kind of physical empathy.
And it's also what's one of the most exciting things about
the concept of neurodiversity that excites me, really. It's really a lot of it that is interesting, hints at the notion that it is a capacity that I have. Maybe it's in show eight, maybe it's in co-eight, sorry, and maybe it's not fully realized, but it's not that somebody is a totally separate human being to myself, but maybe there's another mode of consciousness out there that is accessible some way. And which did make me think again about your work, because there's a reference in the book to a kind of quite simple tool to aid phantom limb sufferers of like phantom pain. Phantom pain is when, say, you've had your arm cut off or your leg, and you still feel that appendage there, even though it isn't. You can't really move it or anything, but you also feel the attendant pain that you might feel having just a dead limb lying there. And a neuroscientist or neuroscientist called V.S. Ramachandran has this box thing, which is like a simple box, two holes. I guess you can modify it according to whatever limb. And you put one limb in there, which is the complete one. And then there's a mirror in it, which mirrors that limb, if I'm right. And so when you look into the box, it looks like you have, let's say, two hands instead of one. And that somehow this heals or seals up a breakage, a neurological breakage or a neuronal breakage. Maybe that's not the right expression, but you know what I mean. And suddenly the pain disappears, and the subject feels not necessarily complete, but maybe at home with their incompleteness.
And it depends on movement too, because so the sufferer would put the whole arm through the hole and move it, and then see it reflected in the mirror, and where the reflection is where their other arm, let's say, should be, but isn't because it's been amputated. So they have this illusion of having two moving arms. It doesn't work if they're just looking at the static image.
Right.
So that's quite interesting, too. There's something about movement which is really key to this. But what's fascinating about this experiment, which doesn't literally have anything to do with mirror touch synesthesia, but it somehow metaphorically it seems to shed some light on it, is that a person feels somehow impeded, literally disabled by this, not just the lack of a limb, but the pain. And they're looking at simply an image. You know, it's just, and it's such a cheaply made, simple thing. It's nothing high tech at all. It could be just a cardboard box with a simple mirror and just two holes cut out with a pair of scissors. And they're looking at this image and, you know, activated by their body. And it's so effective that about, I think, half of its users, after practicing it with it for a few weeks, actually are freed of this pain, which they may have had for years. You know, it's such a simple thing. So I think what's kind of inspiring about that is, you know, it can be seen as an allegory or a metaphor for mentorship or teaching or all sorts of things, but it also just seems to be one piece of evidence for how images can have a profound effect on people's lives and capacities to, you know, this is what people talk about when they talk about affect, I suppose, is the capacity for action or capacity to affect others is presumably a sufferer of this terrible pain, once relieved, is going to feel freer in the world, you know, to take whatever kind of action they need to take.
And affect is something that you don't shy away from as a filmmaker, I feel. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
But I'd also like to make another metaphorical leap, though, if I may, in saying that I feel your films function in some ways like the Ramachandran box, in that some sort of transformative process takes place for the engaged viewer.
Thank you.
When I saw, let's jump forward a little bit. So we're jumping forward to the trilogy of films that you made, I guess partly inspired by the discoveries that happened when you came across mirror touch synesthesia. It's a series of three films. The films were Sensorium Tests in 2012, At the Threshold in 2015, and then the recent one is Theatre of the Tender in 2016. So the one I want to talk about is At the Threshold, which I sort of wrote about and sort of gushed about, really, because it was a real a profound sort of experience for me, seeing this work and being altered in some way, not just by the work, but also the territory that you introduced me to. And it did make me wonder, what are you consciously considering? I mean, this might sound like a basic question, but often sometimes artists don't really consider audiences. But are you consciously considering a viewer when you're making the work? And is the film an offering that the viewer makes a contract with? Or you enter into it, you suspend expectation, narrative expectation, maybe normative expectations of what film should be, and you enter into this contract, potentially transformative, with what you've made. That's what it feels like is happening to me.
And what form did that contract take for you? Just using suspending your disbelief, or what was
you,
that
your films
signing?
Operate in a way. It operates.
So a surrender or.
Yeah, a surrender, a relaxation of expectation, which is what the best in art can offer, which what, you know, galleries can offer, you know, denigrated as white cubes are now, or how critical, you know, the fact of having this sort of interrupted interstitial space, this blank zone where you can think about things is quite powerful for me. But what I mean is that there's a kind of ambivalence that operates in your films. And I don't mean ambivalence in terms of like, oh, I don't know, like an equivocal thing. But like both, let's say like negative and positive things are happening at the same time. What I mean by that is like if you listen to 12 Tone, it doesn't make sense to describe it as, oh, that's a really beautiful melody, or that's a really disturbing sound. It almost is asking you to breach a type of sensory threshold yourself, to consider a new form of music, to consider a new set of aesthetic criteria, or to push at the edges of your own aesthetic criteria. And that's what was I feel like happens with your work. It has this ambivalent territory, which can be quite challenging if you're not up to taking that challenge on.
Yeah. And I suppose it depends on where. I mean, that's really interesting to hear, because I am very interested in how people receive the work. And obviously, I'm thrilled when someone like you gushes about it. That's very flattering, rather than somebody just leaving the room. But, you know, I guess I'd be interested in why they did that, too. But yeah, I was once working on writing a feature-length screenplay about all of this, which in retrospect I think was all too conventional and a bit too tied to conventions of three-act structure and whatnot. And I was working with a film script coach who told me there's a line in communication and clarity with your screenplay between clear and totally unclear. And it's just a line. There's no margin of, no wiggle room, no width to the margin. It's just a line, and you have to just ride that line. And I thought, that is so strange, because each viewer is going to bring a different set of expectations and a different tolerance for either wanting narrative, which would be more of a conventional, you know, kind of TV film viewer, or maybe not wanting any narrative, which might be more of a typical art world viewer, you know, maybe not wanting to have any story to engage with. So I don't think there is just a line between clear and not clear. And so I think I assume there's a sort of a fairly broad audience, and I sort of try to build that into the films. Maybe through this ambivalence you're talking about, I'm conscious of doing that through foregrounding the artifice of the films. Like At the Threshold is clearly staged in a film set, and sometimes the film set moves in strange ways. And
yeah, you that's a reoccurring trope, I think, that some of, well, not all of the films, but certainly some of the films take place in quite controlled environments.
Yeah, almost all of them. Almost all of them. And I think it's sort of a corollary for the artifice of the filmmaking process, or maybe the studio, or maybe simply a daydream in one's own mind. That sense of, limits, but possibilities within the limits.
Is that why I wanted to ask you about sync sound? Is that why you don't use sync sounds so much? Because I suppose in the early films that you were making, so In the Palace and Birds and Close Up Gallery, which I'm really bad at doing this. Like, we both know what we're talking about, but listeners might not know. But,
yes. Yeah. Those were more stylized worlds without any dialogue and with a musical accompaniment, but the visual world and the musical world are somewhat divorced. Yeah.
So, I mean, in that sense, you could see that, okay, using non-sync sound was, well, it, using 16mm film, it's loud. So obviously that causes a lot of issues. But then later on, it seems like more of a conscious choice. And I wondered, is that because you're heightening the artifice, or is that a way to pull people in more? Because you can, it's almost like having a zoom lens on specific sonic occurrences.
Yeah, well, as you would appreciate, somebody who does radio sound is such a powerful and important part of filmmaking. And I think that I got into filmmaking, you know, sort of gradually, sort of slowly wading into it from painting, and just through the years have slowly embraced the different components of it. And initially, the films did privilege the painterly and the sculptural more. And there was a rich soundtrack, but it wasn't wedded to the physical world you saw. And later, it's partly through narrative emerging more and dialogue eventually emerging. But even prior to that, I think I began to appreciate the way that the recording of certain textures, I feel like stroking your palm with your fingernail, if captured with a powerful enough mic, will give you a real sense of being there, as a real sort of intimacy and sense of place and space. And I suppose coming back to this question of, like, not the line, but the margin of space given to the viewer to ride along, I think I want to invite the viewer into a physical world and to recognize the sort of physicality and the artifice of the creation of that world, in a way to invite them into the creating of the film. And in that way, I hope that there isn't just a little thin line between understanding and not understanding, but a sort of a bigger space to move in, to sort of participate in the film. And one of the ways that you participate is by recognizing something like sound, because it's something we know and kind of instinctively respond to.
Where did that impulse come from to pull people in to a space? Was that from painting? Because I know that you were doing sort of abstract painting before you moved into film. Was there a sense that with the abstract painting, you were trying to create a kind of field that would absorb the viewer? Or?
Well, strangely, the films didn't look much like the paintings, the early paintings. In some ways, I think the films were a way of solving the problems of the paintings. That they were immersive and large, but they looked a little bit like closed levelor blinds with light cracking through, which oddly is like the first image in At the Threshold, one of these films that we're talking about. So in a way, they shut out as much as they revealed. And I think that was probably partly to do with just my limitations as an artist in pain, you know, not feeling confident enough to explore the full world there. But yeah, that sense of immersion is something that I do feel film can do. And I suppose that pulling people in is the mirror side to the feeling in of the viewer. So yeah, I hope they do sort of enter into the world, and at the same time have enough sort of traction there that they don't feel sort of lost in it.
So you were born in San Francisco, I think, in 1973. Is that right? Did you grow up there?
Yeah, I grew up in the suburbs of San Francisco, yeah.
So your mum was a psychologist and your father was a cartoonist and filmmaker.
I'm impressed by your research. She's a psychologist and teacher, yeah.
Yeah, so what did you grow up in a house full of artists and intellectuals?
No, not really. It's sort of a, hippie. My father was friends with a lot of kind of like outsider artist types and recent emigres to the U.S. And yeah, it was a kind of, you know, 1970s in Berkeley. It really was that sort of era after the student protests and things like that. Whereas my parents were divorced, my mother lived in a much more conservative, affluent suburb that was very sort of coddled and protected. So I had these rather different experiences.
But I know that because I was looking back at stuff that you'd done before, and I've heard you mention that you once went to a class when you were young of Anna Halperin. And it was like, it made me think you were in this sort of cultural milieu where you were like liaising with all these like prominent figures.
I don't mean to give that impression. No, there weren't a lot of prominent figures around, but Anna Halperin just happened to be literally around the corner from my mother in this very affluent suburb, which is nestled into the foothills of Mount Tamalpais, just north of San Francisco. And this is the place where her husband, Lawrence Halperin, built this famous Redwood dance deck that Merce Cunningham and Yvonne Rainer danced on. And she's still there giving weekly classes at age, I think she's like 93 now. It's amazing. So you can go next time you're in the Bay Area.
I'm planning to.
But yeah, I mean, you know, my mother, as, you know, sort of woman of her time, was interested in modern dance and kind of gestalt psychology and self-help. I mean, all of this was sort of in the atmosphere at the time. And so I think through those interests, we ended up there at a class once.
But you, I mean, looking at your trajectory, your sort of academic trajectory, it's quite smooth. And sometimes it's smooth and focused. You didn't do things at higher education and then do something completely different. So it was humanities at Yale and then an MFA at UCLA, which made me feel like you must have been sure of what you wanted to do. Or a self-possessed young individual. Were you?
I guess so. I mean, I don't sound very self-possessed right now. I mean, I was like, you know, 25 when I went to start to get the MFA, which lasts 3 years at UCLA. It's a very long one. So I guess, yeah, that is quite young. And I suppose that I had the benefit of having a very broad American style liberal arts education as an undergrad, during which time I had no idea what I wanted to do. And it was only sort of after I finished that I kind of returned to this commitment to be an artist. But yeah, having that sort of broad education, I think, was quite helpful because it did teach me how to sort of make connections between different areas. And yeah, then I moved to New York, was working as a nanny and painting, went into the MFA program as a painter, and then sort of veered into the video and then finally into film.
And what made you choose 16mm film to begin with?
Well, at the time, so this is like 1998 or so, the video option available to me, at least as an art student, was very, very lo-fi. It was called Mini DV at the time.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
Little tiny tapes. And it mean, it had an interesting effect in that it really flattened the subject matter and sort of brought this veil over it, this sort of film, sort of this murky looking film. it did not have at all of that clarity or hyper clarity that HD has now. And at first I was very interested in that, and in art school I was making these videos that mimicked paintings and sort of made the most of that flattening effect. But then at one point I borrowed one of my professor's 16mm cameras, Charles Ray's camera, and filmed the same subject on the DV and on 16mm and projected them side by side. And it was such a striking lesson because the video image was, you know, super flat, like a graphic almost. And the 16mm image looked like a window into a sculptural world. And of course, that was very seductive. So I decided to make a film that you mentioned earlier called In the Palace that actually moved around a sculptural set. Yeah.
that does seem really central to you. Again, pulling in the viewer, allowing the viewer to inhabit what's happening on the screen, and for the surface not to be a surface, which is one of the things that also occurs in the Mirror Touch Synesthesia book. This discussion about surfaces not really just being surfaces, but oh, this sounds so pretentiously oxymoronic, but surfaces having depth, you know? I also wanted to ask you about something else, which is Europe. For me, your work really has a connection to Europe. And maybe this sounds strange, but it was occurring to me that maybe nowadays we're experiencing a generation of artists from America, at least, whose connection to Europe is almost, it's not really there anymore. Maybe it's a generational thing, but like your connection to Europe seemed still to be there, maybe through your parents or grandparents, in the way that, say, Scorsese or, like, I don't know, Francis Ford Coppola's had that same connection as well. And in your most recent film, Hunger Artist, you're returning in, well, Prague, Franz Kafka, but also in one of the most significant films that you've made, I think, which was called One of the Things That Makes Me Doubt. Yeah. Which was a fantastic, bold, brassy thing to do. And I think both of those films have an affinity in a way, not just because they're quite long length, but they seem to mark a period of transition, or they seem to punctuate a specific investigation that may have come to an end. But let's talk a bit about One of the Things That Makes Me Doubt. So this is a film that you made, which was kind of, the source material were dream diaries kept by your grandmother, who was undergoing Jungian psychoanalysis. And then they were being interpreted by, or read, and interpreted by some of the actors that, who had featured in previous films that you'd made, which created this real sort of like aware, like textually aware piece of work. Tell me about what it was you were trying to do with this work.
Yeah, I suppose what that film and the new Kafka film have in common is working with the source material that isn't my own per se, somebody else's texts. I think that might be one thing that makes them similar. And I guess the European route to One of the Things That Makes Me Doubt is that my grandmother was a Czech Jew who escaped the Holocaust and ended up in California, and as you say, in analysis and recording her nightly dreams across 30 years. There are literally 30 volumes of these dreams, thousands of pages. And before she died, she granted me permission to read them, somewhat surprisingly, it turns out. And after she died, I wanted to make something out of them because as I read them, it occurred to me that they are literature in a sense, you know, kind of fascinating images, quite beautifully recorded and voluminous, just a lot of it.
Yeah, it was surprising. When I read the description of it, you were saying that they filled shelves and also they're so meticulous.
Yes.
The
yes.
characters that appear become these archetypes and they...
Yeah, I was, yeah. It's almost obsessive. I mean, she's undergoing a process not only of analysis with a therapist, but also kind of self-analysis that carries across decades, where she would record the sort of dominant characters or types, or what Jung called archetypes in the dreams, and created a kind of index card file. Maybe she would do it by computer if it were now, I don't know. In which she was like cross-reference summaries of dreams underneath these archetypes, and through that would track across decades how these archetypes were transforming. So she talked about them as part personalities, and she wanted to see how, for example, a personality that she identified as being a kind of tough survivor character that she maybe had to rely on when she fled the Nazis and had to live in a boarding school in England for some years by herself without her parents. Let's say she had to, you know, rely on this kind of tough male survivor character that she feels comes out in dreams. Later, that might in her older age soften, for instance, and she wanted to sort of see how that was progressing.
Yeah.
And all of that is sort of mind-boggling in its complexity and its thoroughness. But in a way, I was most interested in the dreams themselves because they are so vivid and they digest into themselves, much like I said, film earlier digests all of the kind of cultural happenings of the time and political situations, and but obviously in this very distorted, strange form. So with that film, what I did was not only to get actresses from prior films to read some dreams, but also then cut away to outtakes from some of my films where these actresses appeared to younger, that seemed to have some kind of relationship or rhyme with the dreams. And so I was kind of, I guess, implicitly asking questions about what is a private work and what could be public and how films are like dreams. You know?
It's a fantastic work, and it made all the more impactful by being able to watch everything up until that point. Like, I'm aware when I do interviews with people and I have the privilege of looking over their entire body of work, that these moments of significance sort of strike me all the harder because I'm kind of able to view them. I've got a sort of God's eye view of the creative process, you know. But we're running out of time. And so I want to make sure that we squeeze in and talk about your most recent work, which is a hunger artist. Now, this work was, I was so, when I read the title of it, I didn't make the immediate connection to Kafka because the translation I've got is a fasting artist.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So I didn't realise they were the two, one and the same thing. Mm. But essentially, this is a kind of adaptation, loose adaptation in your style of the short story that Kafka wrote about a fictional kind of sideshow attraction, which is a caged man who is starving himself as a kind of show of heroic endurance over a biblical 40 days and 40 nights. And it's a powerful story because it feels like an allegory for the artist's condition for me. Did it feel that way for you?
Now it does. Yeah. At the time that I was attracted to it, I think I had all sorts of other reasons to be, and maybe they were, psychoanalytically speaking, defenses against recognizing that more basic kind of obvious thing that, you know, that he's a misunderstood artist, one whose audience doesn't get it. And, you know, he has a kind of ambivalent relationship with his handlers, his impresario, and later this kind of circus manager who kind of just want to fit him into the prevailing economic kind of paradigm, and the sort of black humor of the story is that finally he gets what he wants, which is to continue fasting beyond the 40-day limit set by his impresario because that's the most economically feasible amount of time. And, and you know, once he is able to go beyond, it's only when he doesn't have an audience and he ultimately dies. So it's a very sort of tragic story. And I think it's, I'm sure it is something about some corner I'd painted myself into. But I hope it's also something about the limits of a kind of narcissistic, self-obsession that could be true of artists, but could also be true of anyone in this kind of self-promotional, performative selfie culture that we're in, you know.
But and it also feels like, I guess why I'm saying it, there's an affinity with one of the things that makes me doubt is that it does feel like not a conscious break, but you are moving into slightly different territory to where you were before. Because as much as it must feel like a relief to have the book, the Mirror Touch Synesthesia book out, like I was conscious in preparing for this that you're not like the Mirror Touch Synesthesia artist, you know. There are other aspects to your practice, and so I wondered if this was like a, you know, partly a conscious break with that really focused and concentrated attention on this specific subject.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose working with an existing text was an easy, you know, quick way of jump-starting something new. And looking back on it, I'm trying to kind of understand the relationship to mirror touch. In some ways, it's almost an opposite scenario, because this hunger artist, who you could also liken to the anorexic, say, because it's almost, it's a sort of quasi-anorexic person, is also, like the mirror touch synesthete, hypersensitized to images. But it's almost like the inverse, where this hunger artist is making himself into an image and becomes alienated from his body. Whereas I think of the mirror touch synesthete as highly sensitized to images and perhaps more embodied, more somehow situated.
And then also the social implications of that are that, well, mirror touch synesthesia fosters interconnectedness with people. It wouldn't be possible for a mirror touch synesthete to watch somebody starving. So that's kind of interesting for me as well, like this model of how we are communally as a people. Because I felt there were some striking political ramifications for the emergence of mirror touch synesthesia as I was thinking about it previously. In the sense that, like, empathy seems to be something that's totally atrophying at the moment. It's like the least valuable tool that you have. People who sort of have the most prominence now are sociopaths who have a disconnect. So I thought that made it even all the more important. One of the things I also thought was that maybe the panther and the starving artist are the same, and that it's a kind of psychoanalytic you know. Once the blockage is moved, you were saying the return of the repressed.
Yes, right, because at the end of Kafka's story, after the artist dies, the final sort of twist to the tale is that his corpse is removed and he's replaced by this wonderful panther who is everything that he's not. He's muscular, he's wild, he's not aware of being in the cage, and the audience loves it. And so on the surface, that's just kind of bitter irony, but... there's a way in which I think even the Kafka is written in which you can understand it as being, you know, Kafka's envy or Kafka's wish to be that fully embodied being. And it's almost as if the two are two sides of the coin. You could say the panther is a bit more of the mirror touch synesthete. But I think the way that the audience in The Hunger Artist looks on without much interest... is you could liken to this empathy atrophy we may feel in our culture now. And the mirror touch synesthete is a kind of provocation for looking with more sensitivity and more responsiveness.
And I just wanted to read this sentence or passage in the last bit of Kafka's story, which blew me away as I was reading it again on the bus to get here. But it said... in talking about the panther that has replaced the starving artist who's now died, it says of the panther, he said, the food that he liked was brought to him by his keepers without a second thought. Even freedom he did not appear to miss. That noble body, endowed almost to bursting point with all it required, seemed to carry its very freedom around with it. That blew my mind on the bus today. The notion of this sort of such physical splendor that freedom is its own condition in some ways, and it made me feel that that's a kind of liberatory point for somebody creative to be at. Or it can be physical prowess, it can be intellectual prowess, it can be just embracing whatever you're doing. A kind of woolly conclusion.
Here's to the panther.
Here's to the panther. So I guess that's what I wanted to say towards the end of this.
Thank you.
But Daria, we've run out of time, and I just wanted to thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure in turn.
And listeners, I would strongly recommend that you go out and purchase Daria's new book on mirror touch synesthesia. It's amazing and fantastic, and we couldn't quite do it enough justice by going totally deep into all the revelatory things that are in the book. But please, please, please go out and purchase it. And is there any shows coming up soon, Daria, that we see in London?
Well, this coming Friday, the 6th of October, in the evening at Maureen Paley Gallery, I'm going to be reading from the Mirror Touch book, and copies will be available. And then I think it's early next year at Site Gallery, A Hunger Artist will be exhibited. ¶¶